watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. I want to first begin by apologizing to listeners for the hiatus in the readings of The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. I've heard from some people that you miss them. Though they deal with indoctrination and misdirection of purpose, and they'd be an appropriate accompaniment to the material in this week's program, unfortunately there just isn't time, but I promise to resume them next week. We're told our whole lives that the U.S. military is fighting for our country and defending our freedom. Many, if not most people, I think, believe this, at least to some extent, especially those who volunteer to join the military. I certainly agree that defending home and freedom should be the purpose of the military. However, I was born a few years before Dwight Eisenhower's famous warning about the military-industrial complex. And during my whole life, I've never seen the U.S. military engaged in any task but defending the bottom line of America's corporate sector, ensuring them access to cheap resources at the expense of the people who occupy the lands where those resources are located. Some people do join the military, then come to realize there's a discrepancy between the rhetoric and the reality. One of the most famous of those was Marine General Smedley Butler, who wrote in his 1935 book, War is a Racket, quote, "War is a racket, it always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one international in scope. It is the only one in which profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to the majority of the people. Only a small inside group knows what it is about. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few, at the expense of the very many. Out of war, a few people make huge fortunes." Close quote. This week's program will focus on the death of another high-profile soldier who apparently had come to the same conclusion about the present U.S. war, but was killed by so-called friendly fire in Afghanistan in April 2004. I'm talking about Pat Tillman, the pro football player turned soldier. Last week on Capitol Hill, Congressman Henry Waxman chaired a hearing into the lies told by the government and the military about the death of Pat Tillman, as well as those told about the capture of Private Jessica Lynch. This week I'm going to devote the entire program to bringing you extensive excerpts of the four-hour hearing, focusing on the strange circumstances surrounding Pat Tillman's death. I didn't pay close attention to the Tillman case at the time. It seemed a clear example of the administration trying to turn a PR disaster into an opportunity by disseminating a false story on national television about Tillman's death. Tillman, after all, was a recruiter's dream, an all-American pro football star who turned down a $3.6 million contract with the Arizona Cardinals to join the Army in 2002 in response to 9/11. A shining example for young American football fans to follow. Pat Tillman's brother Kevin, also a gifted athlete who'd been drafted to play baseball with the Anaheim Angels, joined up with him, and they were sent to invade Iraq in 2003, then on to Afghanistan, where Pat Tillman was killed. The material you're about to hear presents overwhelming evidence of the government lying to the public about Tillman's death for propaganda purposes. But after listening to the hearing several times as is necessary in order to edit down a four-hour hearing into 2 hours, I have further questions. In searching for background information on Tillman, I learned some things that cast the machinations of the cover-up into a new light. Given the corrupt and ruthless real politic of the neocons and the fanaticism of their Christian fundamentalist political allies. The September 25, 2005 edition of the San Francisco Chronicle newspaper reported that Pat Tillman held views which were critical of the Iraq War and he did not support George Bush's re-election. According to Tillman's mother, a friend of Pat's had arranged a meeting with Noam Chomsky, which was to take place after his return from Afghanistan. Chomsky has confirmed this. The article also reported that Tillman urged a soldier in his platoon to vote for John Kerry in the 2004 U.S. presidential election. What would have happened if Tillman's views on this subject had become widely known before the 2004 election? If the all-American hero who turned down the dream life of fame and fortune to join the army were to speak out publicly against Bush and the war, what a nightmare for the administration that would have been. Even worse than a death by friendly fire, I think. You're going to hear testimony that the military burned all of Tillman's effects in a clandestine manner, his uniform, his body armor, and a notebook. Such treatment of a fallen soldier's effects is not routine, and those doing the burning knew this. Even if they chose to put out a story that Tillman was killed by enemy fire, not by members of his own platoon, this would not seem to me to be necessary in order for the lie to take effect. You will hear that the military claimed the effects were burned because they were, quote, a biohazard. Might they rather have been a political hazard? What was in the notebook that would ordinarily be returned to his family that they might make public in advance of the 2004 election? What forensic clues, such as ballistics and blood spatter patterns, would his uniform and armor suggest? No one in the hearing openly suggests that Tillman was deliberately murdered, but you will hear Mary Tillman, Pat Tillman's mother, discuss the blank wall she hit trying to get a ballistics report on the bullets taken from her son's body, as well as the identity of an Afghan soldier traveling with the unit who was said to have been killed as well. After listening to this hearing several times as part of the editing process, it occurred to me to wonder. You will hear the testimony of Army Ranger Brian O'Neill, who was with Tillman when he was killed. Tillman was behind O'Neill, but close enough that O'Neill could hear his voice even during a barrage of machine gun fire. Close enough to end up lying in a pool of Tillman's blood. Tillman, you will hear, was hit 3 times. O'Neill, who was between Tillman and the shooters, was not hit at all. You will hear that the back of Tillman's head was blown off. I had to wonder if Tillman's uniform would have shown entry wounds or some evidence of bullets from behind. Towards the end, you will hear one of the Congress members ask about one of the Army's reports where a soldier on the battlefield mentioned hearing the telltale sound of an unmanned Predator aerial reconnaissance vehicle. Brigadier General Johnson of the Army's Criminal Investigation Division will testify that he checked out the presence of the drone on the battlefield, but he was told no drone was present. The drone was brought up because it might have taken pictures of the battlefield, documenting what really happened on that day. What caught my attention was the information denying the presence of the drone, Johnson said, came from General Boykin. Lieutenant General William G. Boykin is the United States Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. He has played a role in almost every recent major American military operation as a Delta Force commander serving in Grenada, Somalia, and Iraq. His specialty is special operations, and he also served the Central Intelligence Agency as deputy director of special activities, government speak for assassinations, abductions, and such. In 2003, Seymour Hersh wrote in The New Yorker that Boykin was a key planner, along with Stephen Cambone, behind Rumsfeld's special forces approach to fighting the war on terror. Furthermore, when Boykin was questioned in a congressional inquiry regarding similarities between the current War on Terror Special Operations and the U.S.'s Operation Phoenix assassination program during the Vietnam War, Boykin said, quote, "I think we're doing what the Phoenix program was designed to do without all of the secrecy," close quote. There's something else to know about Boykin. He is a Christian fanatic who believes the war on terror is a crusade against Satan. He made headlines in 2003 with a slideshow lecture he gave in churches across the country. He appeared there not in his dress uniform, but in combat gear. He asked audiences, quote, "Ask yourself, why is this man in the White House? The majority of Americans did not vote for him. Why is he there? I tell you this morning he's in the White House because God put him there for such a time as this. God put him there not only to lead this nation, but to lead the world in such a time as this." Boykin then asked the congregation who the enemy is, then revealed the foe's true identity. "The battle this nation is in is a spiritual battle. It's a battle for our soul, and the enemy is a guy called Satan. Satan wants to destroy this nation. He wants to destroy us as a nation, and he wants to destroy us as a Christian army," close quote. Pat Tillman was a godless opponent of Boykin's holy war and its God-ordained commander-in-chief. I wanted you to have this background in mind as you consider the testimony that follows, which is from the April 24th Oversight and Government Reform Committee hearing on accuracy of battlefield information, chaired by Representative Henry Waxman of Los Angeles. Here's Henry Waxman.
Yeah, Mary Tillman is the mother of Corporal Pat Tillman. Mrs. Tillman has persistently pursued the many unanswered questions concerning the circumstances of her son's death and the shortcomings of the investigations that followed. Kevin Tillman is the brother of Corporal Pat Tillman, and former Army Ranger who served in the same platoon in Afghanistan as Corporal Tillman. And this is his first time testifying publicly about this matter. Thank you very much. You're recognized.
I want to thank Chairman Waxman for holding this hearing and members of the committee for attending. My name is Kevin Tillman. 2 days ago, I marked the third anniversary of the death of my older brother, Pat Tillman, Spear, Afghanistan. To our family and friends, it was a devastating loss. To the nation, it was a moment of disorientation. To the military, it was a nightmare. But to others within the government, it appears to have been an opportunity. April of 2004 was turning into the deadliest month to date in the war in Iraq. The dual rebellions in Najaf and Fallujah handed the U.S. forces their first tactical defeat, as American commanders essentially surrendered Fallujah to members of Iraq resistance, and the administration was forced to accede to Ayatollah Sistani's demand for January elections in exchange for assistance in extricating U.S. forces from its battle with the Mahdi militia. A call-up of 20,000 additional troops was ordered, and another 20,000 troops had their tours of duty extended. In the midst of this, the White House learned that Christian Parente, Seymour Hersh, and other journalists were about to reveal a shocking scandal involving massive and systemic detainee abuse in a facility known as Abu Ghraib. Then on April 22, 2004, my brother Pat was killed in a firefight in eastern Afghanistan. Immediately after Pat's death, our family was told that he was shot in the head by the enemy in a fierce firefight outside a narrow canyon. In the days leading up to Pat's memorial service, media accounts, based on information provided by the Army and the White House, were wreathed in a patriotic glow and became more dramatic in tone. A terrible tragedy that might have further undermined support for the war in Iraq was transformed into an inspirational message that served instead to support the nation's foreign policy wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. To further exploit Pat's death, he was awarded the Silver Star for Valor. The abridged version went like this. Only after his team engaged this well-armed enemy did it appear that the enemy's volume of fire into the kill zone diminished. Above the din of battle, Corporal Tillman was heard issuing fire commands to take the fight to an enemy on the dominating high ground. Always leading from the front, Corporal Tillman aggressively maneuvered his team against the enemy position on the steep slope. As a result of Corporal Tillman's effort and heroic action, the trail element of the platoon was able to maneuver through the ambush position of relative safety without suffering a single casualty. The fight that ensued at Corporal Tillman's position increased in intensity. Corporal Tillman focused all his efforts on keeping the men of his team safe while continuing to press the attack himself without regard for his own personal safety. In the face of mortal danger, Corporal Tillman illustrated that he would not fail his comrades. His actions are in keeping with the highest standards of the United States Army. This was a narrative that inspired countless Americans as intended. There was one small problem with the narrative, however. It was utter fiction. The content of the multiple investigations reveal a series of contradictions that strongly suggest deliberate and careful misrepresentations. We appeal to this committee because we believe this narrative was intended to deceive the family, but more importantly, to deceive the American public. Pat's death was clearly the result of fratricide. It was due to a series of careless actions by several individuals in our own platoon after a small harassing ambush. During this uncontrolled shooting, the driver of the vehicle himself recognized friendlies immediately, but kept driving for approximately 400 meters while the soldiers in the back of his truck continued to shoot at the hillside where the U.S. soldiers were and civilians. The vehicle saw arms and hands waving, smoke was flying, ping gun flares. An Afghan soldier was immediately recognized. They never felt threatened, and they still shut out the village unprovoked. The vehicle behind them clearly saw the U.S. soldiers on the hillside and were calling ceasefire. The end results were the death of Pat and the Afghan soldier, as well as two more soldiers wounded in the village. The signs were available, but the decision to shoot was made. This was not some fog of war. They simply lost control. According to the sworn statement on April 26th by the fellow soldier who was right next to Pat, literally right next to Pat, quote, "I remember watching the friendlies just shooting at us. A 50 cal rolled up into our sights and started to unload on top of us. They would work in bursts, 50 cal for 10 to 15 seconds, 240 Bravo 10 to 15 seconds, back and forth. Specialist Tillman and I were yelling, 'Cease, stop, stop, friendlies, friendlies, cease fire.' But they could not hear us. Tillman came up with the idea to let a smoke grenade go. This stopped the friendly contact for a few moments, and that's when I realized the AMF soldier was dead. At this time, the GMV rolled into a better position to fire on us. We thought the battle was over, though, so we were relieved, getting up, stretching out, and talking with one another. When I heard some 5.56 rounds coming from the GMV, they started firing again. That's when I hit the deck. Specialist Tillman, at this time, was hit by small arms fire. I know this because I could hear the pain in his voice as he called out, 'Cease fire, friendlies. I am Pat effing Tillman, damn it.' He said this over and over again until he stopped," end quote. The facts of this case clearly show Pat and the Afghan soldier were killed by fellow members of his platoon, as well as the wounded soldiers on the hillside, and they knew this immediately. Revealing that Pat's death was a fratricide would have been yet another political disaster during a month already swollen with political disasters, and a brutal truth that the American public would undoubtedly find unacceptable. So the facts needed to be suppressed. An alternative narrative had to be constructed. Crucial evidence was destroyed, including Pat's uniform, equipment, and notebook. The autopsy was not done in accordance to regulation, and the field hospital report was falsified. An initial investigation completed with 8 to 10 days before testimony could be changed or manipulated, and which hit disturbingly close to the mark, disappeared into thin air, and was conveniently replaced by another investigation with more palatable findings. This freshly manufactured narrative was then distributed to the American public, and we believe the strategy had the intended effect. It shifted the focus from the grotesque torture at Abu Ghraib and a downward spiral of an illegal act of aggression to a great American who died a hero's death. Over a month after Pat's death, when it became clear that it would no longer be possible to pull off this deception, a few of the facts were parceled out to the public and to our family. General Kenzinger was ordered to tell the American public May 29th, 5 weeks later, that Pat died of fratricide, but with a calculated and nefarious twist. He stated, quote, there was no one specific finding of fault, end quote, and that he, quote, probably died of fratricide, end quote, but there was specific fault, and there was nothing probable about the facts that led to Pat's death. The most despicable part of what General Kenzinger told the American public is when he said, quote, the results of this investigation in no way diminish the bravery and sacrifice displayed by Corporal Tillman, end quote. This is an egregious attempt to manipulate the public into thinking that anyone who would question this 180-degree flip in the narrative would be casting doubt on Pat's bravery and sacrifice. Such questioning says nothing about Pat's bravery and sacrifice any more than the narrative for Jessica diminishes her bravery and sacrifice. It does, however, say a lot about the powers who perpetrated this. After the truth of Pat's death was partially revealed, Pat was no longer of use as a sales asset and became strictly the Army's problem. They were now left with the task of briefing our family and answering our questions. With any luck, our family would sink quietly into our grief and the whole unsavory episode would be swept under the rug. However, they miscalculated our family's reaction. Through the amazing strength and perseverance of my mother, the most amazing woman on earth, our family has managed to have multiple investigations conducted. However, while each investigation gathered more information, the mountain of evidence was never used to arrive at an honest or even sensible conclusion. The most recent investigation by the Department of Defense Inspector General and the Criminal Investigative Division of the Army concluded that the killing of Pat was, quote, an accident. The handling of the situation after the firefight were described as a compilation of, quote, missteps, inaccuracies, and errors in judgment, which created the perception of concealment. The soldier who shot Pat admitted in his sworn statement that just before he delivered the fatal burst from about 35 meters away, that he saw his target waving hands, but he decided to pull the trigger anyway. Such an act is not an accident. It's a clear violation of the rules of engagement. Writing up a field hospital report stating that Pat was, quote, transferred to intensive care unit for continued CPR after most of his head had been taken off by multiple 5.56 rounds is not misleading. Stating that a giant rectangle bruise covering his chest that sits exactly where the armored plate that protects you from bullets is being, quote, consistent with paddle marks is not misleading. These are deliberate and calculated lies. Writing a Silver Star Award before a single eyewitness account is taken is not a misstep. Falsifying soldier witness statements for a Silver Star is not a misstep. These are intentional falsehoods that meet the legal definition for fraud. Delivering false information at a nationally televised memorial service is not an error in judgment. Discarding an investigation that does not fit a preordained conclusion is not an error in judgment. These are deliberate acts of deceit. This is not the perception of concealment. This is concealment. Pat is, of course, not the only soldier where battlefield realities reach the family and the public in the form of a false narrative. First Lieutenant Ken Ballard died in Najaf, Iraq, just one day after Pat's fratricide went public. His mom, Karen Meredith, was told that Ken was killed by a sniper on a rooftop. 15 months later, she found out that he was killed by an unmanned gun from his own vehicle. Private Jesse Booty was killed May 5th, 2004 in Iraq. His family was told he was killed in a vehicle accident. A year later, they received the autopsy report, and they found that he was shot in the back. The Army was forced to concede that he was accidentally shot by a Polish soldier. Just recently, out of nowhere, a lieutenant showed up at their family's house and told them that an officer in his own unit had shot him. They are still looking for answers. Sergeant Patrick McCafferty was killed June 22, 2004, from what the family was told as, quote, an ambush by insurgents. 2 years later, they found out that those, quote, insurgents happened to be the same Iraqi troops that he was training. Before his death, he told his chain of command that these same troops that he was training were trying to kill him and his team. He was told to keep his mouth shut. About a year ago, I received a phone call. I was at my mom's house, and it was an emergency breakthrough from the operator. It happened to be a woman named Dawn Hellerman from North Carolina. So it was 2 o'clock in the morning her time. Her husband, Staff Sergeant Brian Hellerman, was killed in Iraq. She was tired of receiving new official reasons why her husband had died. She was desperate for help, so she called us. The system had failed her. Those soldiers deserve better, and their families deserve better. Our family has relentlessly pursued the truth on this matter for 3 years. We have now concluded that our efforts are being actively thwarted by powers that are more important, that are more interested in protecting a narrative than getting at the truth or seeing that justice is served. That is why we ask Congress, as a sovereign representative of the whole people, to exercise its power to investigate the inconsistencies in Pat's death and the aftermath, and into all the other soldiers that were betrayed by this system. The one bit of truth that did survive these manipulations was that Pat was and still is a great man. He is the most wonderful older brother to ever exist. Pat wanted to leave a positive legacy based on his actions, and he did that. But Pat's death at the hands of his comrades is a terrible tragedy. But the fact that the Army and what appears to be others attempted to hijack his virtue and his legacy is simply horrific. The least this country can do for him in return is to uncover who is responsible for his death, who lied and covered it up, and who instigated those lies and benefited from them, then ensure that justice is meted out to the culpable. Pat and these other soldiers volunteered to put their lives on the line for this country. Anything less than the truth is a betrayal of those values that all soldiers who have fought for this nation have sought to uphold. Thank you for your time.
That was former soldier Kevin Tillman, Pat Tillman's brother. The next question is from Representative Elijah Cummings.
To the Tillman family, Mr. Tillman, you said that you believe that the military was hoping that your family would sink quietly in your grief. I want to thank you for not sinking quietly in your grief. We have an email that was written on April 28, 2004, 6 days after Pat Tillman's death. I don't know if you've seen this up there on the screen, have ever seen this email, but it describes how the White House was asking for information about Corporal Tillman for the president to use in a speech at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I'd like to make this email part of the record, Mr. Chairman.
Without objection, that'll be the order.
Let me read you what the email said in part. Quote, just received a call from Mr. Curran, White House speechwriter. Mr. Curran said the information is for the president's speech at the Correspondents' Dinner this coming Saturday. It will probably be televised by C-SPAN, end of quote. The next day, April 29, 2004, an urgent communication was sent to the highest levels of the Army command structure alerting them that friendly fire was a suspected cause of death. This communication is called a personal 4, that is P4, memo. As I understand it, P4 memos are military communications that require special handling. Mr. Tillman, you probably know more about this than I do, but from what I have been told about P4 memos, they are for eyes-only communications, meaning that the addressee must open it personally and read it immediately. Are you familiar with that? Are you aware of that type of memo?
I am not, sir. I mean, I understand it. I don't know any more than you do. I was a enlisted guy, E4.
I understand.
I didn't get up that high.
I understand. This P4 memo was sent by General McChrystal, who was your brother's regiment commander in Afghanistan, to three high-ranking generals, including General Kissinger, the head of Special Operations, and General Abazad, the head of Central Command. The P4 memo warns, and I quote, "It is highly possible that Corporal Tillman was killed by friendly fire," end of quote. And it seems to be responding to inquiries from the White House, and here's what it says, and I quote, "POTUS," meaning President of the United States, "and the Secretary of the Army might include comments about Corporal Tillman's heroism and his approved Silver Star medal in speeches currently being prepared, not knowing the specifics surrounding his death," end of quote. It goes on to express concern that the President or Defense Secretary might suffer, quote, "public embarrassment if the circumstances of Corporal Tillman's death become public," end of quote. I would also like to make this P4 memo part of the hearing record.
Without objection.
One question we have is whether this P4 memo made it to the White House, and here's what we do know. On April 28th, the White House asked for information about Pat Tillman for a speech the President was giving. The next day, the P4 memo was sent, stating that Pat Tillman was killed by friendly fire and warning the President against mentioning it. When the President spoke at the correspondence dinner, he was careful in his wording. He praised Pat Tillman's courage, but carefully avoided describing how he was killed. It seems possible that the P4 memo was a direct response to the White House's inquiry, and if that is true, it means that the White House knew the true facts about Corporal Tillman's death before the memorial service and weeks before the Tillman family was told. Mr. Tillman, do you know whether the Army ever investigated how high up the chain of command this information went? And second, do you think this ought to be investigated now? You or Mrs. Tillman?
I don't know how far they went up. It looks like they stopped. The Department of Defense looks like they stopped at about General Kinzinger. But it seems pretty disingenuous, and I don't have the answers because these things get piecemealed to us, whether they're leaked to the press or whatever. That's kind of why we were hoping we could get to you guys, because you have that access. You know, my mom is specifically, among a lot of other people, have really worked hard to gather information and try and figure out through all these redactions to figure out who's who. I mean, we're just figuring out. It took us like 9 months to figure out who actually did the investigation, the second one. Well, the first one that was also the first official one. So it's tough to get information, and that's why it's a bit disingenuous to think that the administration did not know about what was going on, something so politically sensitive. So that's kind of what we were hoping you guys could get involved with and take a look. I mean, we only can go so far. We don't have access to these people. We don't have access to the unredacted information. We're kind of landlocked.
Well, I see my time is up, but we'll do the best we can.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Can I say something to that, please?
Yes, sir.
Can I say something to that? I'll tell you what we do know, because
Mary Tillman, Pat's mother.
I've been doing a lot of reading about Rumsfeld, and former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, and I believe, just from what I've learned about him as a person and his expectations for his staff, that he would have had this information. He wasn't an individual who appreciated other people contacting the White House without it going to him first. I can't imagine that this memo could have been sent to General Abizaid and General Kinzinger and General Brown with the expectation they would tell the President, because Rumsfeld wouldn't want there to be any direct line, because he liked to be the guy to go to the White House. So I believe that he would have intercepted this memo first of all. The other thing is that he was, he had written Pat a letter, which I don't think he makes a practice of doing that, and it wasn't an extravagant letter by any stretch. It was about a two-sentence letter. But the fact that he sent Pat the letter, and Pat was a very high-profile individual. He was probably the most high-profile individual in the military at the time. The fact that he would be killed by friendly fire and no one would tell Rumsfeld is ludicrous, because he would have had a fit. I mean, to have it come, you know, be known to him after the fact would have been extremely upsetting to him. And I have read, you know, a particular book on him, but there's a lot of research I've done on the internet, and, you know, this is my conclusion. I have nothing to back it up. I admit that. I have no paper trail, no facts. But just knowing the type of individual and the way he operated, I believe these generals would be absolutely foolish to not tell him.
Mrs. Tillman, you don't know whether it was investigated all the way up the chain of command.
No, I don't know how far they
investigated it. But you think that it should be.
Yes, of course.
Thank you very much.
Representative Dennis Kucinich.
I would like to explore some questions relating to the destruction of physical evidence. And if any of these questions become too sensitive, let me know. We have we've been told, and according to documents, that that orders were given to destroy Corporal Tillman's clothes after the incident, and to burn what was in the bag for security purposes, and that a soldier testified that he burned Corporal Tillman's uniform, socks, and gloves, and one armor plate, which it appeared there was an indentation in the top right corner, and also burned a small notebook of Corporal Tillman. Now, I know that, Mr. Tillman, your family has gathered a lot of evidence about the contradictions. When you looked at this matter relating to the destruction of evidence, do you have any comment as to why a medical doctor did not sign off on the destruction of the uniform?
No, sir. I don't know why he would. I don't know why that would be. I don't know why any of his uniform would be cut off, because they refer to it as a biohazard. Well, Pat was a biohazard. And they avoid mentioning who cut the uniform off him, who made that decision to cut the uniform off. Because a lot of this narrative talking about how they gave him paddle marks, you know, he had paddle marks on his chest, and we had Dr. Buck's respected guy take a look at that stuff, and it was clearly bruises on his chest. And you've got these inconsistencies, like why would they want to cut his clothes off? What possible reason would you cut his clothes off when he did not have essentially from here back? I mean, he had a facial structure. And that was it. And he got there in 90 minutes after the firefight, and that was gone. And they tampered with his body. They cut his clothes off. They said that they tried to save him. Transferred to ICU. I mean, you can't leave paddle marks. It's a physical impossibility to leave paddle marks on somebody 90 minutes after the fact. And that's excluding the other statements saying they came in there and Pat was on the table. And he was there with all his clothes on 30 minutes after the fact. So it's closer, you know, looking like 120 minutes where his body really wasn't touched. And you've got all this stuff that it just doesn't make any sense. You know, why would they cut it off? Why would they burn it? How a medical doctor would allow a bunch of sergeants to roll into his domain and have people taking his stuff off and burning it. And some of the emails are really strange, you know, like quietly burning it. You know, no one's watching, people looking behind their back. It's real weird. I mean, you've got the same stuff we have, but.
You had talked about the extent of your brother's injuries. And when you were told that CPR was attempted, understanding the extent of your brother's injuries, what did you think about that?
Well, at the time, we didn't get the...
After the fact, we all received.
We didn't know it was CPR. We didn't know they tried to perform CPR.
Well, okay, let me explain. We got Mr. the Jones. Autopsy. It's on.
Could you speak close to the mic, please?
We received the autopsy about 5 months after Pat was killed, and on the autopsy, it said that there were these 3.5 by 3/4 inch marks on his chest that were consistent with an attempt at defibrillation. And I thought that was bizarre because the autopsy also said that Pat had no brain due to trauma. So it perplexed us that they would try to resuscitate a man who had no brain. And I was under the impression that he had died, and they deemed him dead immediately. So how could he even have paddle marks if he was received so late? So I had my daughter-in-law, Pat's wife, get the field hospital report, or FOIA the field hospital report. And we finally got it almost 9 months later, I guess. And I was absolutely shocked, because the field hospital report doesn't say anything about defibrillation. It says CPR performed, transfer to ICU for continued CPR. And that was extremely strange, because Pat was dead for 90 minutes before he got to the field hospital, and he essentially had no head.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know my time for a question has expired. I just want to say to the chair that it appears that there was an elaborate effort here to conceal the circumstances of Corporal Tillman's death, and the evidence that's being presented here seems to confirm that. And, of course, the destruction of his notebook is something that I think this committee ought to be spending a little bit more time on as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Kucinich. Mr. Issa?
Question from Representative Darrell Issa.
My youth was spent during the Vietnam War. I was an ROTC, I was a soldier in 1970, but I was an ROTC cadet on the Kent State campus in the early 70s. And that was a time in which they were spitting on military uniforms. It didn't matter if you were a private, a corporal, a sergeant, or an officer, you were somebody that people could treat badly simply because you served in uniform. And apparently they were mostly treating members of Congress pretty well. Now we're dealing in a kind of a new era in which we seem to want to say the soldier is good, but they are bad. And so I want to follow up with just a couple of questions to try to make the record clear, or have you make the record clear. And I'll start. It's two different situations, but if we can go back and forth, I think there's some similarity. Mr. Tillman, who are they in this case? Are they the soldiers who were part of the fratricide? Did they do something willfully wrong, or did they do something that you want us to understand was just wrong today, other than screw up and kill one of their colleagues?
Yes, sir. The firefight itself was due to, based on the evidence, it looks like it's gross negligence, but it looks like criminal intent to criminal negligence, which is what the first officer concluded, possible criminal intent, in which he tried to push off to CID, and somehow it never got to him.
So you're saying that they fragged your brother deliberately?
No.
Okay,
no, sir. There's a difference between homicide and criminal negligence. It's like if a kid's in the street and you're driving and you run into him. You just didn't see him, but you ran into him anyway. That's unfortunate, but you're going to be held accountable for driving into a kid that's standing
sure.
in the street.
Sure. No, my other committee I keep slipping to is judiciary, so I have the good fortune of going back and forth between these two. So you're saying they were improperly trained, leading to mistakes made on the battlefield?
I didn't say improperly trained, sir.
Okay. They were properly trained, but they made mistakes.
I said they were out of control, sir.
Okay. So they...
You're referring to what? There's the American soldiers that did this, sir. They would be the American soldiers on that aspect.
But if you're referring
to the instance, sir, yes.
No.
But
we have to establish the theys here. So one they are E1s, 2s, 3s, 4s, 5s, up to a lieutenant. That's one they. In the aftermath, you're saying that they include a three-star general.
Yes, sir.
And the entire chain of command.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. Tillman, or Mrs. Tillman, do you think that there was a conspiracy, and I heard some of the emails that were sort of the opposite for that reason I'm asking, do you think there was a conspiracy or involvement by people politically connected, in other words, elected or appointed in political roles, that fostered the untrue statements about your brother or your son?
Yes, sir.
And who are they, and what is your evidence?
I don't know, sir, who they are. I just know the evidence is leading to a point, which is why we came to your committee, sir.
Okay, what evidence is leading to that point?
Part of the evidence is the P4 message sent by the head spook of all the special forces. It is not a sit rep. It is a warning to these people. This information, this is something that's very politically sensitive, and it is, in my opinion, very disingenuous to think that they did not know, especially based on what was going on at the time. It is a bit speculative right now, and that's why we're here. But the whole thing, as a whole, if you look at its parts and put it together, it's absolutely absurd. This whole thing is unbelievable from this manufactured story to what really happened. There's such a disconnect. And to think that the generals would sua sponte this on their own, I don't think that's a very reasonable answer. And based off of the email traffic, based on how a lot of these wars are perception based, there's a lot of information, there's a lot of stuff that's controlled. I think it's imperative that the committee take a look and see if that's the case. I personally am pretty confident that they did have something to do with this, because they're the ones that ultimately benefited from that story.
Thank you, Mr. Issa.
The next question is from Representative Clay.
Now, Ms. Tillman, I want to turn now to Pat's Silver Star Award. The committee has a copy of the original citation that supported the Silver Star Award. The certificate says that Pat Tillman put himself in the line of devastating enemy fire. It also says that Corporal Tillman was mortally wounded while under fire that resulted in the platoon's safe passage. Ms. Tillman, there's nothing in here at all about friendly fire, is there?
No, there's not, sir. They're very careful to stay away from that.
So anyone who reads this, including you, would believe Pat was killed in a firefight with enemy forces. Isn't that right?
Yes, sir.
Lieutenant Colonel Bailey has stated that he was the one who recommended posthumously awarding a Silver Star to Pat Tillman, claiming that his actions prior to his death by friendly fire merited the award. But the final version of this award focused on the supposed battle with enemy firefighters at the time of death. Do you have any idea why Colonel Bailey or the other drafters of the award failed to correct this key fact?
I can speculate, and I do. But I think because the situation out there was so horrific that, and I want to say that, you know, Kevin indicates that he believes that the Rangers are trained for the most part quite well. And so we're not attacking the training. And these soldiers themselves, in a different situation, may have performed quite well. But at this particular moment, they got excited. And they were not afraid when they were asked about this particular engagement. Not once did they say they were afraid. Not once did they say they were being fired upon. They said they were excited. Or one said, I wanted to be in a firefight. General Jones asked, you know, did you PID your target? No, I wanted to be in a firefight. When they asked, did you see waving hands? Yes, we saw waving hands. What did it look like? General Jones asked. It looked like they were trying to say, hey, it's us. And yet, they fired at them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clay.
Thank you.
Representative Christopher Shays, who commissioned a report by the Inspector General of the Department of Defense during the previous Congress. The author of that DOD report, Acting Inspector General Thomas Gimble, was at the hearing, and we'll hear from him later in testimony.
I chaired the National Security Subcommittee. Now I'm its ranking member. We asked that this investigation happen, but you're not happy with the investigation. I went out for a little bit, done by the Inspector General. I'd like one or the other to, or both of you, to just tell me again why you're not happy or take issue with this investigation.
Mary Tillman responds.
First of all, I just want to clear something up. This family has great respect for the military. My dad served, my uncles served. You know, I mean, I just want to make that clear. The most comforting sight right after Pat died was the sight of General Kenzinger, which is very sad to me because I don't know what his role is in the cover-up, but he was very kind. He was very impressive in his uniform, and I felt very proud that that he was there. And in other words, we were made to feel rather foolish, I think. I mean, there's an element of the betrayal. You feel rather foolish. Well, how didn't I not pick up on this? And all of the officers we were in touch with prior to uncovering, you know, sort of this deceit, we had respect for. I mean, you know, I thought General Jones was a very gracious man, and I even gave him a picture of Pat because, you know, he knew Pat, and I felt like he was betraying us in the end, although he did do us a great service because he gave us a lot of information. But his conclusions were not valid. I mean, based on the evidence, how could he say there was nothing wrong, nothing nefarious had happened? So I just want to make it very clear that this family does have respect for the military. We had great trust in the officers that came to us.
I know my light went up, but I would just love to have you highlight maybe one or two of the biggest flaws with this.
Okay,
report.
I understand.
I'll
that.
Highlight one for you, yeah. Sir. If you could turn to page 53, it talks about, and this is redacted, so you got to bear with me. It talks about the narrative for the silver, the witness statements for the Silver Star. And the two Silver Star witnesses, one is here, which you guys had to fight to get. That's Brian O'Neill, that the military fought tooth and nail, as you know, to keep him from testifying. But the narrative on that top right-hand side, read it. There's flat out saying, I didn't write this. I don't know who wrote this thing. It wasn't me. I didn't say this. And is that addressed in the conclusion? No. I mean, that's fraud, correct? To falsify a witness statement in a Silver Star award, fabricating it with these kids' names on it. That is an example of something that it's sitting right here. Why isn't it addressed in the conclusion? How come no one's held accountable for this? So the whole thing is riddled with nonsense.
So if I could,
sir,
summarize, there are indications here that the Inspector General was not as diligent, did not pursue obvious questions, and so you have a lot of unanswered issues here because of this report.
Well, they accepted the CID investigation. I mean, you know, the IG, you know, they came to conclusions about certain generals that did some things they shouldn't have done. I believe these generals are not, I think these generals were under orders personally by someone higher. I don't think that these generals acted on their own. But I mean, yes, the IG did say that there are four generals that are culpable and there's five other officers that are culpable. I understand that. However, they also said that the CID investigation was valid. They deemed it okay. And the CID investigation was a travesty in my eyes. I think it was ridiculous. There were absolute indications of ROE violations riddled throughout every single report that was done. They didn't try to find out really who the name of this Afghan militia soldier was. For 3 years, no one has known his name. And then we're told his name is Tani, which I think is kind of ridiculous, being it's a tribal country. They usually have more than one name, and I don't think that is his real name. I wanted to know who actually commanded the AMF soldiers. I asked the IG agent specifically to find that out, and, you know, he was communicating with CID, so I, you know, he said he would make sure they were aware of that. When I asked the investigator, you know, who commanded the AMF soldiers, we didn't look into that. When I asked them what was the conclusion with the ballistics testing, with the bullets that were taken from Pat's head, I didn't look into that. We never got any report. I mean, in every way, they're dodging us. And the IG condoned that, even though they, you know, make the public believe they did such a grand job because they pointed the finger at four generals and five other officers. That's a smokescreen. These officers are scapegoats. McChrystal's memo coming out the way it did is a pure indication that they are feeling like scapegoats.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shays. Mr. Braley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Tillman, I want to thank you for your eloquent and compelling testimony. And with your permission, I'd like to address my initial remarks to your parents. When I heard about your son's death, the real causes for his death, it took me back to when I was a 13-year-old growing up in Iowa. A story hit the Des Moines Register that captured the attention of everyone in my state. It was about a young man named Michael Mullen, gone off and gotten his college degree and was a graduate student when he was drafted into the Army. During the pre-dawn hours of February 18, 1970, on a jungle hilltop near the village of Chu Lai, South Vietnam, an outgoing shell from a U.S. Army howitzer accidentally struck a tree top and exploded above the men of Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, AmeriCal Division. Six were injured, two were killed. One of them was Michael Mullen, 25, the fifth generation of his family to farm the same fertile Iowa acreage. Michael was pierced by a small crescent of steel that tore a hole in his heart. He was sleeping and died instantly. The Army listed their son as a non-battle casualty, a category that they were to learn was used rather loosely to keep down the weekly figure of war dead. an anguished war protest letter from Peg Mullen, Michael's mother, to President Nixon, brought back a note from a White House clerk assuring her that the president was truly sorry that her son had died, and attached to the note were copies of President Nixon's Vietnamization speeches. Another letter from the Adjutant General's office informed the Mullins that the non-battle casualty had been posthumously awarded the Bronze Star and the Good Conduct Medal. However, they also received a voucher they were asked to sign to receive the pay due their son Michael at the time of his death, and they refused to sign, demanding a full accounting from the government of the circumstances of how he died. And when they finally got that full accounting, it came with a deduction for advanced leave time that their son no longer had a position to make up. Peg Mullen turned this into a personal crusade, taking the money that they received from their son's death benefit to take out full-page ads in the Des Moines Register, consisting of 714 crosses representing Iowa's Vietnam War dead. One of the results from that action was that they had their family phone tapped. And as I heard the story of what your family has gone through in order to get a full accounting from the government that your son served with honor, I was reminded of how we tell ourselves over and over again, never again, and yet we seem to go through this every time we're faced with a crisis like we face right now.
Well, I would like to say, I think it's really important, because before someone says anything to us, I want to say it first, because we have been asked over and over again, well, what can we do for your family? How can we appease you? And it makes me sick. It's not about our family. Our family will never be satisfied. We'll never have Pat back. But what is so outrageous is this isn't about Pat. This is about what they did to Pat and what they did to a nation. And there is evidence in accumulation of what is about 12 binders on Pat's death. I've condensed it to one or two. And this is evidence that something really awful happened. It's your job to find out what happened to him. It's, we have an institution in place to find out what happened to him. And that's really important. And we are coming to you. Pat died for this country, and he believed it was a great country that had a system that worked. It's not perfect. No one has ever said that. But if there's a systems in place to allow for it to work. And your job is to find out what happened to Pat, is to find out what happened to Patrick McCafferty, to what happened to Kenneth Fowler, to all the other soldiers. And by making up these false stories is exactly what Jessica said. It's you're diminishing their true heroism. It may not be pretty. It may not be like out of a John Wayne movie. But that's not what war is all about. It's ugly. It's bloody. It's painful. And to write these glorious tales is really a disservice to the nation. And the nation needs to realize this is an ugly war. Everyone should be part of it. Everyone should understand what's going on. And we shouldn't be allowed to have smoke screens thrown in our face.
Thank you. One of the articles that I've read after the Pentagon report was released noted that the report did not attempt to explain why the military command stuck to its feel-good story of combat heroism at the time of the Abu Ghraib scandal, which you referenced in your testimony, Mr. Tillman. Can you, either one of you, talk about why or what explanations you have received as to why that explanation has never been provided?
General Jones, when he interviewed General McChrystal for his investigation, he asked, and this is the actual document that General Jones provided us, he said, once you became aware that this was possible fratricide, was there a conscious decision made not to tell the family of the possibility? If so, why? General McChrystal answers, there was a conscious decision on who we told about the potential because we did not know all the facts. I did tell the senior leadership, and then there's a redaction. We all know now who that he's talking about the possibility prior to the memorial ceremony, because I felt they needed to know that before the ceremony. I believe that we did not tell the family of the possibility because we did not want to give them some half-baked finding. But the irony is that's exactly what they did. They made up a story. They presented it to an honorable military individual who thought he was given the true facts, and he was mortified that he wasn't. I mean, the Army didn't even presented themselves to be held accountable for the lie. They handed it over to someone else.